Hello and welcome to Talkin' Golf Live on this Wednesday, November 3. I'm Rod Murray. Thanks for tuning in. Before we get to the golf discussion this week, I've got a little bit of housekeeping to do. Those of you who've been listening for a while will know that we've tried a few different ideas for Talkin' Golf over the past couple of months, with everything from one to three shows a week. But I think we finally settled now on how we're going to do things for the foreseeable future. I've always liked the idea of a live format for the show, including the ability for listeners to call in during the broadcast with questions and responses to the guests that we have on. Talkback radio is still a popular medium, but for the most part, it lives in the car while people are out and about. But with the incredible pace of technological change, it is now possible to do just that over the internet and still reach people on the move thanks to smartphones and mobile internet-capable devices. Literally, millions of people are on trains, buses, and in cars commuting to and from work each day, and a healthy percentage of them have a device in their pocket which allows them to take the internet and this show with them. So the aim from here is to try to build that live audience and the interactive nature of the show with guests and topics that people will hopefully find engaging. If you're one of those who has mobile access to the web, give it a try and let me know what you think. It's all experimental at this stage, but I'm hoping we can help enhance at least one of your weekly commutes with some good old-fashioned Talkback radio. Now, once the show is finished each week, it will still be available as a podcast, if that's your listening preference. And we've also made some changes there, going to a different server, which offers a better sound quality for the post-broadcast show. If you've subscribed to Talkin' Golf through iTunes, there is a new feed address, which you can find at the new look Talkin' Golf homepage, though I am fairly certain that the old one will still work for at least a little while yet. Now, I know none of that has anything to do with golf, but it's all somewhat important stuff for what we're trying to do here. So, exactly that, with our resident swing guru, David Willow Williams, and a special guest known to many of you through a thread that got out of control on the iSeek Golf forums a couple of years ago, and now through his own advanced ball striking website, John Lag Pressure Erickson. Willow, nice to have you along as always.
Oh, thank you, Rod.
Things treating you well down there, I hope, coming
very,
out of winter.
Yeah, weather's getting better, and it's good to be outside without jumper and a jacket and an umbrella up and everything else on. So that's fantastic.
And the golf courses are a bit more full, which is always nice
yes.
to see. From your perspective, Willow, we've got a pretty special guest today, a guy that I've known for some time, had a few dealings with him, written a few stories about him. He's a little bit of an internet sensation, almost by accident. We'll get him to tell us a little bit about that story as we go. Those on the internet might know him as Lag Pressure. His real name is John Erickson. He played the tour down here in Australia in the late 80s and the early 90s. He's a good player in his own right, and he's got some very interesting theories about the swing. John, or I'm probably going to call you Lag from this point on, a welcome to you, my friend.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm here in sunny San Francisco, home of the future World Series champion Giants, hopefully.
baseball. Sorry, mate. We're in the wrong hemisphere. Good luck. I hope your team wins, whoever that is, however it works. Lag, let's start with you. I wrote a story for the current issue of Golf Australia magazine about how you're working with Bradley Hughes, and we might touch on that first because, of course, Brad's doing a couple of different things and bits and pieces. One of our best ball strikers over the years that we've produced here in Australia, who kind of lost his way in the last 10 years or so. He's been working with you of late, and he told me he's hitting it like he hasn't done for a long time. Tell us a little bit how you first came to be in touch with Brad, and then a little bit about some of the things you've worked on.
Well, oddly enough, Bradley and I knew each other a little bit from our playing days. And when I won the Windsor Charity Classic on the Canadian Tour, I won by one shot. I shot 17 under par for 4 days, and I beat Bradley Hughes by one shot. So we had our real kind of duel in the sun, so to speak, out there. I think after all these years, and we lost touch with each other, and he found me, I think, on iSeek, and contacted me and said, "Hey, do you remember me, Bradley Hughes? You know, I'm the guy that you beat, you know, when you won at Windsor." And so it was kind of a surprise finding that we kind of met again. Well, he had been following a kind of epic golf blog there on iSeek. And
that's your first understatement, lag. Epic golf thread. What did it go to, 100,000 pages or something?
Yeah, somebody emailed me the other day and said even though the thing was shut down on iSeek, it's had like another 60,000 views or something since it was shut down or whatever. That's pretty crazy. But anyway, so Bradley found me there, and then we talked on the phone and kind of caught up with things. And, you know, he went on to have a really great playing career, you know, after we had played against each other in 91. You know, he went on to do all these great things, which didn't surprise me because he was, you know, always just such a great player. And so we kind of, you know, reintroduced ourselves, and he said that he wanted to come out and visit, and, you know, he had me take a look at what he was doing and that sort of thing. So that's kind of how it started. That was our introduction. And he's been helping me out on the advanced ball striking website, and he's been really great there, working with some of my students as well, and it's been nice to rekindle that relationship. Bradley's just a really great guy.
Now, of course, the thing that attracted him to come and see you in the first place, Lag, was that some of these theories and notions you discussed about the golf swing really hit a chord with him. Brad was a guy who grew up in the Persimmon and Blade era, which is obviously long gone, and learnt to swing the club that way and extremely well. I think 16 greens around wasn't that uncommon for Brad when he was swinging it well. What are some of those notions? Some people would call it old school, the theories that you talk about, and I noticed that pretty high on the list, or I think you call it the holy grail of golf, is this notion of holding the shaft flex to impact. Talk to me a little bit about that and why that's so important.
Well, basically, you know, if you were to take a golf club and you walk up to, say, a door jamb, and you set the club head down against the door, and you were to press with your hands and create a flex in the shaft, that's going to give you more feeling and sensation in your hands than if you weren't pressing. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
That makes perfect sense.
So golf is a game of feel. It really is a game of feel. You can talk mechanics and all this, but ultimately, once your mechanics are in place, golf is a game of feel. It's all feel. And what I try and do with the better players, once we're kind of beyond mechanics, is to work on feel. And what we want to do is to work on holding shaft flex. And there are, you know, some mechanical things that we can do to enhance that. But ultimately, that's the direction that I like to go with the good players, is to get them holding shaft flex. And to do that, you have to be accelerating through the impact area rather than trying to sort of time the shaft straightening into the ball, which would be what I would call swinging. Swinging is more like cracking a whip. You know, you're trying to time the cracking of the whip tip as compared with hitting, where you're accelerating the pivot and the hands through impact, and that's more like, you know, punching your fist through a wall.
Well, there's something that I often hear you talk about, and I think it's where you start all your lessons, is these two words, impact alignments, and it's something I've heard Lag talk about as well. Just yep. Explain to us a little bit, what are impact alignments? Why are they so important?
Oh, look, it's because the golf swing is moving, you know, especially through impact, and the ball only knows impact. The only time you've got an influence, a real influence over the golf ball, is at that split second when the club face and the ball are in contact. Yeah, so, I mean, working on alignments, and you can't feel, you know, a position at impact. So if you can work on your alignments and you can make sure you're keeping those alignments throughout the swing, which is going to help you achieve, you know, impacting the ball better. So, I mean, I start at impact and teach my players how to hit the golf ball. It's not about pretty swings and, you know, making somebody look really pretty. I mean, it's about effective swings. You only got to see the tours all over the world to see all the non-pretty golf swings making money. So, but what they all have in common is being able to hit the ball really well and control what they're doing. So, you know, if I like to start at impact and work backwards. And I, you know, from what I've read, I think Lag does as well.
Well, in fact, many of your drills don't even involve a golf ball, do they, Lag? The things that you get your students to do drills, and Brad told me this, that don't even involve a club necessarily for players of his level. He told me that he can go for 5 or 6 weeks without picking up a golf club, but he does the drills that you and he have worked on, and when he does pick up a golf club, he just stripes it.
Yeah, that's right. The golf is an athletic move. You know, the golf swing is a very, very athletic motion of the body, very biomechanical, and it takes a certain amount of muscular conditioning and training to really strike the ball, you know, at a top level. So the muscles in the body don't really know whether there's a ball there or not. There's certain things that you can do, certain drills and things that we work on to try and work certain intentions, because I don't teach positions. I teach motion and movement. Everything we do, there's always a starting position and a finishing position, and that's either going to be all the way to the finish of the swing, or it's going to be striking into like a, you know, say an impact bag or something like that. Similar to like boxing, you know, they train with a bag, a speed bag, and the big medicine balls and the heavy bags, because they need resistance, and the muscles are going to respond to that force and pressure of resistance. So that's basically how I like to train the swing and the body. And then as we move on further along, then we get into hitting golf balls and finding how to align your body and shoot the gun. It's all about aiming and firing the gun and shooting it correctly. And everybody has a different alignment. You know, not everybody should be lining up necessarily straight down the line, putting a club on the ground and this sort of thing. You see guys lining way left. You see a lot more guys lining left than you do lining right.
Now, Lag, the other thing that you talk about a lot, and something that I'd like you to explain to me, I'll be honest, I sometimes get lost in some of the threads on the Advanced Ball Striking Forum, which we'll put a link to on the Talkin' Golf website so people can go and have a listen. It is interesting stuff if you're into the golf swing. But something that you often talk about is a pivot-driven golf swing, and I never really figured out what you were talking about, but I found a video on one of my other forums the other day of Gary Player talking about where the power in the swing comes from, and very much sort of, you know, the mid area of the abs and the top of the legs where all the strength was, and that made some sense. Talk a little bit about a pivot-driven golf swing and why you think, or why that is the best way to swing a golf club.
Well, a pivot-driven golf swing is basically, you need to drive the body and the pivot through from impact and beyond to hold shaft flex, because there's nothing left at that point. If you look at the golf swing and you look at the basic power sources that are available, we can cock our wrist, we can rotate our forearms, and we can rotate our torso. Okay, and the right arm can have some effect in this, the straightening of the right elbow, but I think it's overrated. The right arm can take on different roles. It can push, it can pull, it can be relaxed. It can be like a hinge, it can be like a motor, it can be pulling against the club. If you were to let go of the club at impact, it would hit the ground and move out to your right. Can you picture that?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, if you're going to be swinging kind of around your body, then you're going to have to pull against that force. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So in that sense, the right arm would be, you'd be trying to bend the right arm through impact rather than straighten the right arm through impact. But, you know, again, this all has to be done correctly with the torso, basically the torso rotating back and forth. If you look at the great ball strikers, they were all very pivot driven, meaning they had big shoulder turns, both back and through, but not necessarily a lot of arm travel. In other words, the arms don't travel as far as the rotation of the shoulders. So when I say pivot driven, it's basically the rotation of the torso and the shoulders doing the bulk of the work in the golf swing. And this is then supported by resistance in the legs and the ground and foot pressures.
Which I also wanted to come to. Willow, is this the mistake that most of us in the mid-handicap range make, is that we tend to swing with the arms and shoulders, the upper body? That's where we feel we're driving the swing. And in fact, it should be coming from The middle of the body is lag, says, from the torso and the upper leg.
Yeah, look, I think what I see quite a lot is, you know, you get the people who do swing over the top and slice the ball is their sequencing and how their body's moving. And, you know, from the top, they, you know, they're rotating their shoulders and trying to get their hands to generate some speed from the top, and then the club moves out away from them, and then it's got to come back in and across. So it causes either, you know, your straight pull if they square the face up to their plane, or it causes their big slice. So, and you see in the good players, you know, it's ground up. You know, it's the knees and then the hips and really using the, you know, the body to start generating the sequence of events to get, into, I guess, the right alignments to drive the club down into impact when you get it in the right spot. So I think, you know, the videos like what we saw with Gary Player was really trying to get, you know, the person that he was teaching to start driving in with the body and get that right so the arms can fire the right way rather than just, you know, trying to give it to it from the top with the hands and then getting them all off plane and all out of whack. So,
Lag, when those of us in the sort of, you know, 10 to whatever handicap range swing the club, I suspect most of us think about what our shoulders and our hands and our arms are doing. Should we actually be focusing our attention on that middle section, as Player describes in that video, which I'll put a link to on the website? And if we think about that, will that automatically make our hands and arms behave more like what they should?
I don't think you can really think about much of anything in the golf swing. Your golf swing basically is what it is until you change it, you know, assuming that you want to change it. You know, a lot of people just go out and play golf and they just enjoy swatting it around out there and they don't really think that much about stuff and they're just out there to have a good time, have a few beers or whatever. But, you know, the more serious player, I think, you know, at some point you're going to have to address your technique. And I think when you're out on the golf course, you know, it's just ball target. You know, whatever you've got, there's the ball, there's a target. You line up your body in a way that you think is going to, when you swing, it's going to send the ball towards the target. And if, for most people, they're going to have to line up way right of the target because they come right over the top, like Dave says, and they hit a big pull at the target and they hope it doesn't, you know, slice. So they use the upright gear and the offset clubs and all this to try and, you know, help that out. And that's how most people play golf. But that's not going to get you out on the tour.
No, it's certainly not, and we promised we weren't going to go into the club off air, but we'll be here for hours if we get started, Lag. We've talked about it before. Lag, can anybody swing a golf club well, firstly, and secondly, can those who believe that they want to swing the golf club better and possibly can, do they appreciate the work that's involved, and what percentage of people who say they want to play better are prepared to make the commitment that it genuinely takes to get better at the game?
Well, you have to, you know, practice, you know, no different than learning a musical instrument. And I mean, most all of us have had, you know, some kind of musical, took a couple piano lessons when we were 6 years old or something. You know, whether you're playing the piano or the guitar or learning to swing a golf club, you know, you're going to have to learn the chord sequences and the scales and, you know, all this stuff takes time. You have to practice and practice and practice. And anyone that I know that got good at anything in life has spent a lot of time practicing. And if it's golf, you know, hitting thousands of golf balls, having good instruction, you know, working on, you know, some kids naturally are going to be pretty good at golf by just picking up the club. Others are very much a struggle. It's just like anything else.
I'm pretty sure, though, Lag, I read in a couple of my magazines recently, I can just buy a better game. I think they're selling them now in the form of new clubs.
We're not talking about equipment.
Or marketing.
Started.
Yeah.
Fair enough. So it does take that sort of commitment. Now, the second is, can anybody do it, though?
Yes. I mean, assuming you don't have any big physical disabilities or anything. But, yeah, of course. Can people turn their shoulders? Of course they can. Can people rotate their forearms? Of course they can. Can they cock their wrists? Of course they can. People can do these things. They just need to be shown the correct way of doing these things. And the biggest problem in golf is the fact that our eyes are sitting kind of above the action. I mean, we're kind of looking down on the shaft, kind of moving around our body, and we get this kind of bird's eye view looking down. And everything needs to visually be moving in arcs and circles, and we need to know what those arcs and circles need to look like. And most people, you know, intuitively, they think, well, okay, there's the ball and there's the target. I see a straight line, and they want to see the club head moving in a straight line back and forth through the ball without a lot of club face rotation, because it would seem like straight back and straight through and square the club face from square to square. But that's just not how it works, unfortunately.
Brings me to something I wanted to talk to both of you about. And Lag, I know in round terms you're fairly new to the coaching perspective. You spent most of your time playing and deconstructing the golf swing and working your way through the Golf Machine book and pulling that to pieces and putting it back together. Lord knows what you might have done to yourself through that process, one can only imagine. But I'll start with you, Willow. This notion of coaching, and as Lag points out, good coaching, if you really want to actually get somewhat competent at the game, is crucial. What are some of the differences between working with somebody, say, like myself, who's played for about 20 years at a mediocre standard, never much better and never much worse, and somebody like, I think, one of your trainees, one of your students you're working with is playing at the trainee championships or has done this past week, and he's obviously at a vastly different level technically. What are the differences between working with those two sorts of people for you as a coach?
Look, I think with, you know, what I believe with the good players is they've got their way that they move the golf. I mean, everybody does, but they've got their way that they move the golf club, and they do it fairly competently. I do use video quite a bit just to show them and give them a visual perspective on how they're moving the golf club, but then I try and relate it to, you know, feelings that they're working on to, you know, because I think the good player, and I go back to when I, you know, play and practiced a lot, you know, you just work on that feeling of getting it through, and then I'd monitor that, you know, checking, you know, maybe which way my divot's going and what my ball flight's doing against what I'm feeling to make sure that I'm still doing the right thing and not either overdoing it or make sure I'm still doing it. But really working a lot on timing as well, you know, helping them feel like they're squaring the club face up to produce, you know, the shot that they want, rather than, you know, after getting their hands a bit ahead or their body a bit ahead in relation to timing, where, you know, it's going to send the ball slightly offline. So it's really just trying to help them understand what their swing and what their feelings are going to create in the form of golf shots, and
as opposed to some of the technical issues you might see with a player like myself, where it might be you need a grip or a setup adjustment, something you're obviously is throwing out the rest of your swing.
Yeah,
and needs to
look,
be fixed before you.
Even the good players, you know, I've got possibly technical deficiencies in their swing, and you know, a lot of those things might be either a work in progress or you just learn to live with them. You know, picking it up steep and dropping it under plane, or doing whatever. But what they do is repeat it, you know, on a very regular basis, and they do know about their game. So I think it's helping them understand what they do and how they do it, so they can repeat it more often.
Lag, you touched on something there that I wanted to talk to you about. It a little bit controversial in that magazine piece that I wrote that I mentioned earlier. And Brad told me that he now practices exclusively virtually with Persimmon and heavy blade irons from some time ago. And some people are suggesting that that's maybe not such a good idea, given that I assume when he goes out to play tournaments, this is not what he's going to play with. Just explain a little bit how that can work. He says it's worked for him, so there's no question that it's, you know, in his own opinion, it's been a good thing. Explain a little bit about how that might work and whether there is any danger with taking on a program like that, where you practice with Persimmon and blades, but you play with more modern equipment.
Oh, no, there's no danger at all. In fact, you know, Tiger Woods has admitted to practicing with the Persimmon driver extensively when he's home, you know, over the last, you know, 10 years. I mean, I don't know what Tiger is working on, but I, you know, about 5 years ago, I read an article on Tiger, and he talked about how he practiced a lot with Persimmon when he was home. The brain simply just needs the feedback. It needs to know where dead center is. If you miss it a little bit, your brain needs to know. And it's not just the feel, but it's also the sound. You know, there's a difference between the sound of a fat shot and a thin shot, and one that's really hit solidly or one that's out on the toe. These all make different sounds, and especially with Persimmon, you know, you can really hear the difference in the sound. And our brains really need the feedback of the visual, the sound, and the feel, and all these things to help keep redirecting and guiding us to what is going to be our best action, motion, and the purest kind of golf swing that we can make. So no, I could go out with modern gear and, you know, play it fine. I mean, it would just need to be set up correctly as far as the mainly the lie angles, because I play off irons that are 6 degrees flat. But I wouldn't be you know, comfortable walking into, you know, irons that are 2 degrees upright. Although I could do it, it just wouldn't be a good thing. But using heavier gear and then going to lighter gear, I mean, it's pretty it's easier to do that than it is the other way. Like, I wouldn't have trouble going out playing modern gear. I'd hit the ball a lot farther, and I'd just have to, you know, make the adjustment pretty quickly there. I think it'd be tougher to go the other way, to play light gear and you go back and play heavier gear, because your muscle tone just isn't going to be up to speed. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And look, and I think it's been tried before. Brant Snedeker, and I think you posted a link to this story on the Advanced Ball Striking Forum. He went out and played around with his current gear and some old persimmon and blades and a softer ball, an old-style ball. Mm-hmm. I don't think he got within 8 shots with the old gear from memory. I think he shot 81 or 82 or something and just couldn't figure out how to play it, because, of course, he'd never been that way. There's a whole generation of golfers, isn't there, Willow, who've never experienced that early morning winter Melbourne jolt of not hitting one out of the middle with a blade club at 7 o'clock on a cold winter's morning.
There's nothing like blading a blade club on a you know, 0 degrees on freezing point with some ice on the ground. There is nothing like the feeling like you're going to snap your fingers off.
And the desire never to do that again, exactly. Which is a great motivator, isn't it?
I think they call it tough love.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I picked up on that Lag just mentioned was the sound. And it's really interesting that during my lessons on some of my students, I teach them the sound as well. Especially you can pick it up when chipping quite a bit. You can hear, you know, if they're picking it up off the bottom groove and they're just picking it up off the surface and not hitting the sweet spot. So, And that's one thing, you know, I do during a lesson is to make the point, I'll turn my back and have them hit shots, and you can hear that distinctive, you know, sweet spot ball strike, ball and then down into the ground, or whether it's that slightly duller, you know, ground before the ball, a little bit thuddy, or the click of just the club face or the blade hitting the ball. So, I teach my students not only to sense and feel how they're hitting the golf ball, but also tell by the sound that it makes as well. So I'm glad I'm on the right track with the sound and having that backed up by Lag.
But, I'm fairly certain that an experiment was done some years ago where they took some tour players, they blindfolded them, and within a swing or two they were hitting the ball just as well. Then they blocked their hearing off completely, and the players really struggled. In fact, some of them had virtually had air swings, because the audio feedback is more important than the visual, according to that. So that doesn't surprise me, even though it's, you know, obviously as the club hits the ball, it shouldn't really make any difference to the actual hitting. But apparently that whole notion of audio feedback is far more important than the visual.
Well, I managed to notice that down.
There's an anticipation of the sound. There's a certain sound. You know that let's say you're hitting a chip shot and you've got a 60-foot chip shot. There's an anticipation as the loudness of the click that you're going to make, especially even more so today with these plastic golf balls that we hit.
Okay, so you would think that makes sense to you, Lag, that the hearing is almost more important than the sight?
Yes.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
I guess, and I know we weren't going to talk about clubs, but I guess this is why the big companies have sound technologists to program the sound that their driver's going to make. I guess that's.
He's not a fan of that.
But
noise,
I guess this is why some people are coming to the pro shop and you know, you've got the Pro V1 and the Pro V1X, and you've got 20 markers asking for Pro V1X, and I say, well, why are you using that ball? Oh, because it goes further. Well, I think it just because it's slightly harder, it makes a slightly louder bang, and it gives them the impression that it's going further, where it's where it's actually not.
And at what? $27 a sleeve, I suppose you're probably quite happy to sell it to them, will I?
Oh, I'll just sell them the other Pro V, which still costs the same.
Same amount of money. But better for their game. Lag, I wanted to touch on this with you. I did a story with you a couple of years ago. You went off to, I think it was the 2009 US Open. You went and tried to qualify with your favourite Tony Penna driver, and I think you took along a set of 1960s Hogan blades because this is the only equipment you play with. I don't think you've ever used a club that's been made after 1980 or so, to the best of my knowledge. Are you ever going to have another go at that? I think you only missed out by a shot or two, didn't you?
I'll probably go again. The main thing is to find the right golf course. I have no doubt that I could qualify for the U.S. Open using persimmon and blades, but I need to be on the right kind of golf course. I don't want to be on a 7,400 yard wide open golf course. I want to be on the kind of golf course where, you know, good shot making and strategy and ball positioning is going to win the qualifying, as compared with just launching it 340 yards or whatever and not really caring about where it goes.
What did you take from that experience when you went to try to qualify for that Open? From the other players that you played with alone, I imagine you must have got some unusual looks on the first tee and probably right through the whole round, just given the nature of the equipment you were using. But what did you take away from that, and what was their reaction to you? I would imagine people would have been surprised at how well you do play with this old gear.
Yeah, the official on the first tee was pretty shocked when I, pulled out a persimmon. He asked me if that was, he goes, "Is that a persimmon?" Looking at me really crazy. And I said, "Yeah." And I asked him, I said, "Are these still legal?" But I don't like the golf balls. I don't mind it for slower greens or softer greens. But the U.S. Open qualifying, they had the greens really firm and fast, and I hadn't played on anything like that since I started playing again a couple of years ago. And I just couldn't hold the ball in the greens. I looked in the bag of some of the other players after the round, and, guys have these milled faces and textured faces and, square grooves that are sharpened with diamonds or whatever. All the stuff to try and, get spin on these plastic golf balls. It's not like the rubber Bellotta balls that were very high spinning. The high spinning balls, the good players would use it to, we would use it to our advantage because we could shape the ball. We could curve it a lot or we could curve it a little, but we would use that to our advantage to shape the ball. I was really shocked at how the modern golf ball, as it goes out, a guy will hit it way offline, it'll hit its apex, and then it'll just drop straight down. It doesn't keep going like the Bellottas where you end up two fairways over, So that's what they're basically doing is, just making the ball go as far as it can with a little less spin on it than the Bellottas. But I think, Bradley, he doesn't feel he hits the new ball as far as the Bellottas. He felt he could compress the Bellotta ball a little bit better. So it'd be interesting to hear from some other guys like that that have played, both the balls.
What about your take on the players that you teed up with? I know that you and Brad went to the President's Cup in, 2008 over there in San Francisco. And if I recall, 2009, sorry.
Yeah.
If I recall, you weren't overly impressed with most of the ball striking you saw.
No, it was pretty pathetic. I mean, it was almost embarrassing because I, as a golfer, as a touring professional, I always took pride in our ability as a collective, to not just me, but when we would play our tour, say when I was playing on the Australian tour or the Canadian tour, we'd show up at a golf course and I was always happy to see how well, we would play the golf course. And as a collective, if I didn't win the tournament or somebody else wins the tournament, but it was embarrassing. I saw, Mike Weir snap hook three drivers. I mean, hooked them hard, he's left-handed, so he's hooking them to the right, but it wasn't very impressive. I mean, here's one of the supposedly top players in the world, and I haven't even hit a shot like that in a couple of years, I saw Adam Scott miss a green with a 7-iron about 20 yards right of the green, and I just, you're just kind of shrugging your shoulders going, what are these guys doing? It's not, of course, they get it up and down, they usually don't make bogeys because the trees, even though the trees at Harding Park, or there's a lot of pine trees out there, but they have them all cut up, trimmed up from the bottom. So it's basically like hitting a shot through a few telephone poles. It's not really like in Australia when I was playing down there, you missed the fairway, you paid in flesh.
you hit it into that tea tree on the sandbelt. There's no coming out of that, is there?
You'd be all scraped up trying to get it out of the Anita bushes or whatever down there.
Let's wrap it up. We didn't even really scratch the surface, I don't think, Lag, but I do urge people to go and visit your site at advancedballstriking.com. I think Willow's probably going to sign up as a member. I'm already there as a member.
I'm already done.
Already done.
Already on.
It really is a terrific site, and it's a testament to you, and congratulations on it. And I can't thank you enough for taking the time today. It's been most enjoyable.
Yeah, thank you. It's always a great pleasure to talk to you. And
great to have the both of you here, and I look forward to chatting to both of you again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks, fellas.
Cheers, Rob. Okay.
Cheers. Bye.
Plenty of interesting stuff to consider there, and as I said, if you are into swing theory and how the golf swing actually works, you'd be well advised to make the trip to Lag's site at advancedballstriking.com. Lots of really interesting discussion and debate, and plenty of quality posters as well. As always, a link to that site on the Talkin' Golf homepage, and it will also be in the links section from now on. Now, that just about wraps it up for this week's edition of TalkinGolf.com. Thanks for tuning in. I do hope that you've enjoyed it. I'll be back again live next Wednesday at 8 a.m. Sydney time, which is 5 p.m. Tuesday in New York and 9 p.m. Tuesday in London. And starting from next week, we'll be taking your calls during the show if you've got something that you think you'd like to offer. For details on how to do that, drop into the New Look Talkin' Golf website, and there's a link there which explains how to go about it. But I will give you one hint. If you're outside the US, Skype will be your best bet. Otherwise, it could cost you a fortune. Now, with a bit of luck, we'll be coming to you next week from the Victoria Golf Club in Melbourne, where Tiger Woods will be teeing up for the second time at the Australian Masters. And there's not too much doubt that that will be the most exciting week in Australian golf all year. As you'd imagine, I'm looking forward to that, and I'm looking forward to your company then also.